Right, brethren, we spoke recently on the story of David, King David, to see what lessons we could learn from his life. You'll recollect that David was described as a man after God's own heart. Yet unfortunately, at the peak of his success, so to speak, there was a major sin with Bathsheba, the murder, the premeditated murder of Uriah, and of course many, many horrible consequences that flowed from that. It's a real, really good lesson that sin is not good. Sin does have consequences. You know, David genuinely, deeply repented, but the problems that took place in his life thereafter were really, you know, pretty upsetting. And there are many lessons that you and I can learn in the Bible from the lives of other people, the experiences which they had, whether it's individuals like David or others, or the nations like Judah and Israel. Indeed, although we're not turning there, 1 Corinthians 10 says that these things were written down for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So they were written down, and you and I can read them, and we can hopefully learn from the experiences of other people. You know, we can also learn from our own experiences, but experience, although it's allegedly a good teacher, can be a very hard teacher, and sometimes it's better to learn from other people's experiences. That way it can be a bit less painful for us. Today we're going to look at the example of Joseph, way back in the book of Genesis, and you could perhaps start turning there to Genesis 37, where we'll be starting. But Joseph is, seems to me at least, to be a truly outstanding individual. I mean, really, really a great example. You can think of Abraham, also very great, but, you know, Abraham had a few deviations. He lied. He tried to help out God's plan and foul things up rather badly. We can think of Jacob, or Israel, who was a great deceiver. We can think of David, with his adultery and murder, a man of bloodshed. When you come to Joseph, actually, Joseph just seems to be genuinely impressive, almost from start to finish. Really quite an impressive individual. So, a brief introduction. Jacob, or Israel, had 12 sons, you might recollect, the 12 sons of Israel. Jacob had two wives and two concubines. That's four ladies. That sounds like serious trouble. So you got 12 sons, four mothers, one father. It's a recipe for, I think, quite a difficult family life. And Rachel was the mother of two of the sons of Israel, Joseph and also Benjamin, who was the youngest of all. So the lads were apparently quite a handful, as we'll see as we go along. So I start in Genesis chapter 37, beginning in verse 2, which says, "This is the genealogy of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah," that's two of the ladies, "his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father." So he's out with four of the other boys, helping to look after the sheep. He's 17 years old as the story opens. And he brings back a bad report. It probably was an accurate report, but it suggests that these other lads weren't doing a very good job in one sense or another. And of course, I guess they'd see Joseph as somebody guilty of tattletaling, carrying back bad news to their dad. That wouldn't go down too well, I'm sure. Verse 3, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him." And this really is not wise of Jacob or Israel. It's not wise, I'm sure, of any parent to show favoritism to one of the children. You know, if you get one child, that's easy enough. They tend to get spoiled anyway. But if you get two kids or three kids or eight children or whatever, it's bad news. You might, perhaps as a parent, be particularly fond of one or two of them. But really, not a good idea to display that, to demonstrate that. And really, you know, Jacob probably was largely responsible for some of the problems that happened here. He showed great favoritism to Joseph, the son of his old age, made him this tunic, it says, of many colors, and people debate, well, was it many colors? Or some modern translations say a coat with long sleeves. Well, maybe. But whatever it was a special coat, embroidered or colored or very long, not the usual sort of garment you'd have. And it just demonstrated that this guy is the favorite son. So the rest didn't like that. They were jealous and envious, and actually, at the age of 17, Joseph was hated by his brothers. Moving on to verse 5. Now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, you and me, binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." Now, with brothers who hate you, this is not really very wise. Joseph, he's only 17, to be fair, naive, innocent, but definitely not wise. And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. And it does say hate. And they just, it's not a question of not liking him. They hated this guy. You know. Then he dreamed still another dream, verse 9, and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream. Hey, isn't that great? I've got some fantastic dreams I have. Ooh, wait to hear this one." This time, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. Wow. Even the heavenly bodies are bowing down to me. Aren't I something special? And he told his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So his dad wondered a wee bit, I guess. This is some quite special dreams that young Joseph is having, and perhaps there's something to them. His father thinks, that you and I, of course, who know the whole story, know that there is something to them. And almost certainly Joseph believed that these dreams were special, that they came from God, and I guess in some ways these dreams may have helped Joseph in the difficult years ahead to remain motivated and trusting, because he had these dreams and he knew they were special dreams, real dreams with importance, and perhaps saw them even at this age as destiny from God. But definitely looking at Joseph's way of relating to his brothers, he lacked tact. Perhaps the dreams were encouraging to him, but perhaps he should have kept them to himself. Probably not spread them around to this particular audience, because one of the lessons that you and I can learn is you don't always have to speak what's in your mind. Might be true, might be accurate, might be something you feel very strongly about, but that does not mean necessarily that it's always wise to blurt out what's in your heart to any audience that you're around. Keep your place there and turn to Proverbs 13:3. Look at a couple of Proverbs and then straight back. So Proverbs 13:3. Now at 17, you know, Joseph wouldn't necessarily know this. I guess he'd learn his lesson in later life. But Proverbs 13:3, you and I can certainly learn these lessons. Proverbs 13:3 says, "He who guards his mouth preserves his life, but he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction." And obviously the meaning is just be careful what you say. You know, guard your mouth. Just because you've got lips and teeth and a tongue does not mean you should waggle them at all times. Depends who you're with. Depends what you're going to say. You know, a fool just opens their mouth and pours out anything. But you and I should be more careful, a little bit thoughtful about, is it wise to say this? Is it wise to say it now? Is it wise to say it to these people now? And he who guards his mouth and is careful what emanates from it. It says, you know, preserves his life. And in a sense, you know, Joseph came quite close to losing his life, and largely brought about by A, his father's favoritism, and B, Joseph blabbing about what a fantastic future he had and how they'd all one day come and bow down before him. Look at Proverbs 25:11. Proverbs 25 and verse 11 says, "A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver." A word fitly spoken, or one translation says, a word spoken at just the right time. The right word, well chosen, spoken at just the right time, is like an apple of gold in a setting of silver. And of course, conversely, a poorly chosen word spoken at entirely the wrong time are definitely not attractive. Let's go back to Genesis 37. So one of the things that we can learn straight away is being tactful, diplomatic. Sometimes that's the wiser course of action. In fact, another proverb, not in the Bible, is that diplomacy is thinking twice before saying nothing. Just think twice, then don't bother. That's diplomacy. And that was a bit lacking, understandably, I think, in Joseph's early life. So let's pick up the story in verse 12. "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.' So he said to him, 'Okay, well, here I am, let's go.' Then he said to him, 'Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me.'" Don't know if that means that Joseph was a bit uneasy over what his sons were up to. They had caused him quite some problems in earlier chapters. So perhaps he's a wee bit like an update, just what's taking place, Joseph, if you could do that. "So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?' He said, 'I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks.' And the man said, 'Well, they've departed from here, for I heard them say, "Let us go to Dothan."' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan." They'd moved, I think, another 10 or 20 miles away, perhaps getting as far away from their father as they could, and who knows what plans of mischief they had up their sleeves. But anyway, verse 18, "Now when they saw Joseph afar off, even before they came near him, they conspired against him to kill him." Right, this is your brothers. You know, a few verses ago they hated him, but now they see him coming because this either long-sleeved or brightly coloured tunic he's got on, quite visible, you know, a mile away or further, and it says they conspire against him to kill him. Well, that says something about the family. It's what you might class as a dysfunctional family, where the brothers want to kill, you know, the second youngest. So that tells us something about the rest of Israel's sons, and they're not a nice crowd at all, are they, at this stage? Verse 19, "Then they said to one another, 'Look, this dreamer is coming,'" or the margin says, "this master of dreams is coming." So really get up their nose, this dreaming business, this special visions you've got. "Come therefore now, let us kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say," you know, obviously to the father, "or some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will happen or become of his dreams." So, I mean, literally this is what they're planning. They're going to kill the guy. This is their younger brother, and they want to kill him. They're planning to kill him. But Reuben, who's the oldest, the elder, says, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him," intending that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So, you know, Reuben, a bit half-hearted this, a bit wishy-washy, because Reuben was the elder brother, and he could have said, "Guys, forget this stupidity. That would be a major sin. I know you don't like him, and he can get up your nose at points, but he's our brother. You know, cut this out straight away." And as the elder brother, he might have got away with that, but he didn't. He obviously had a bit of a fear wouldn't face up to his brothers. They're planning to kill Joshua. He thinks, well, let's just throw him into this dry pit here, and then he's planning, I'll come back later and, you know, rescue him. So Reuben, a bit wishy-washy, because Reuben is believed to be the forefather of modern-day France, a nation which is also believed to be a bit wishy-washy at times. No further comment. Verse 23, it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. They're quite tough, aren't they? Quite hard. They've taken the garment that offended them off of Joseph. They've tossed him into a pit. It says in later chapters that Joseph, you know, cried and pleaded. He was only 17 to be sort of rescued and taken out. And what do? They sat down to eat a meal. They really are quite hard-hearted individuals. You wouldn't really want to meet this bunch. Then they lifted their eyes, verse 25, and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there in that we kill our brother and conceal his blood? And this is interesting, the first comments of a Jew in the Bible, Judah himself, are, what profit is there in this? And Jews are often ridiculed somewhat for being all interested in money, and banking, and finance, and profit. But it's interesting, the first words recorded in Scripture from, you know, the Jew, Judah, are, what profit would there be in killing him? Let's sell him. Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh. I don't think that was the important point. The important point was, think of the money we get. And his brothers listened. It seems at this point that Reuben had wandered off somewhere, because he appears to be a bit unaware of these developments. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit. He might have thought, oh, right, they've come to the senses and they're pulling me out, and, you know, I'll get some of the dinner and then we can all go home together. But if that was in Joseph's mind, he was destined to be disappointed. They sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So this is bad news for a young boy. He was his father's favorite. He was probably had quite a privileged position in what was a fairly wealthy family. And now, at the age of 17, he's, I guess, might be sort of chained or whatever, and he's off to Egypt as a potential slave. Then, verse 29, Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit. And he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more, and I, where shall I go? I'm the eldest, I'm responsible. What's happened? And I guess they told him what had taken place. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it's your son's tunic or not? I mean, they are really a bad bunch. This is an old man. And they're just thrusting this bloody tunic, and they know exactly, of course, what it is, in front of the father and saying, is this Joseph's bloody tunic? And he recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And so they were cruel to their father, cruel to young Joseph, hated him, but even their dad, you thought, you know, more respect there to sort of do it in this way, just thrust this bloody garment into his hands and say, is that your son's bloody garment? Is that his blood all over him? Is it, old man? So really not a pleasant bunch. Verse 35, and all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. And decades would pass before, of course, the truth came out. Verse 36, now the Midianites had sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And it is interesting in passing there that, you know, Jacob was deceived here by this, you know, bloody tunic that was given to him. He thought his son was dead. That's the impression he got. But of course, you know, Jacob had a bit of a track record of deceiving himself, hadn't he? Because he deceived his father by wearing somebody else's tunic, Esau's at the time, and covering his arms and hands in animal skins. So, you know, Jacob in times past was quite a deceiver, and he was being deceived by this bloody garment, although it's understandable why, obviously, he understood that. But now let's pick up this tale of Joseph, which begins in chapter 39, because this is now a challenge for Joseph. He's been the favorite son. He's had the special privileges. He's had a couple of dreams of greatness in his heart. But now he's been sold into slavery in another country. How will he react? How would you react? How would I react? I can think of many ways. Bitter. Twisted. This is so unfair. Why has this happened to me? You get negative. Would you have a pity party? Probably. Would we murmur and grumble and, you know, beat our fists in the sand? And, you know, is that what would happen to us? That's the challenge, isn't it? Because you and I will all hit obstacles in life. Hopefully not as bad as Joseph's. He's now gone from being, you know, the wealthy landowner's son with all the privileges to being just a slave in the clothes he stands in. But you and I will face difficulties. Obstacles, many challenges. Scripture is absolutely clear. Hold your place there and turn to Acts 14. Read verses 21 and 22. Acts 14. And 21 and 22. And Paul... is Apostle Paul's here, busy traveling and preaching. And when he had preached the gospel to that city and made many disciples, verse 21, they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith, and saying, we must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. So Paul had to really work hard to encourage people, to strengthen them, to say, look, there will be difficulties in life. There will be problems. It's not all going to be, you know, easy, plain sailing. You're going to hit challenges, perhaps one after another. So you need to realize, people, that it's through many tribulations that we will enter the kingdom of God. And of course, he'd just been beaten up a bit earlier. That was an illustration of why things don't always go, you know, swimmingly easily. But it's true. You and I, as Paul says here, will hit plenty of obstacles in our lives. Look at 1 Peter 1, verses 6 and 7. 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 6 and 7. And so we just read what Paul was teaching. Here's Peter, and he says, verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, knowing that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it be tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So, you know, Peter says, you've been grieved by various trials. And that's actually not unusual. You know, various trials happen. Verse 7, that the genuineness of your faith may be found to praise, honor, and glory. Or look at Psalms 34:19. Back to the Old Testament, Psalms 34. And verse 19. So it's pretty comprehensive throughout the scriptures. It says here, many are the afflictions of the righteous. Now, you don't stop there, of course, but that's definitely the case. Many, not actually, unfortunately, few. It says, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but, that wasn't the end of the story, but Jehovah the Lord delivers him out of them all. But you're delivered out of them having been in them. And many are the afflictions of the righteous. So the big question that you and I are always going to have is, we're going to be guaranteed to have obstacles and disappointments and frustrations in life. Question is, how will we react? Now, let's watch how Joseph reacted, because young man, a good background, but his hate-filled brothers have sold him now into slavery, essentially. He's now in Egypt. Pick up the story in chapter 39 and beginning in verse 1. Now, Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. So Joseph is in slavery, has been purchased by Potiphar. It says, verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Eternal was with him, and that the Eternal made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he, Potiphar, made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put in his hand. So it was, from the time that he had made him overseer of his house, and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was in all that he had in the house, and even in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So Potiphar was the captain of the guard. That's sort of the head of the secret service, I guess, in today's more modern world. Captain of the guard, he's over security, over state security. It's a high position. So, you know, Joseph didn't just end up anywhere as a slave, you know, working in some distant, you know, farmer in a field or something. He ends up, well, he doesn't want to be a slave at all, of course, but if you're going to be a slave, I guess not a bad place to be one. Because you're working for a very, very high official in the government. And it's pretty clear, reading those few verses, that Joseph maintained a pretty good attitude, because he's receiving favor from God and favor from Potiphar. Now, if he'd been miserable and sulking and having pity parties, could God have blessed him? No way. Would Potiphar have been impressed if he'd been miserable and whining and grumbling and belly aching about how unfair life is? No way. But it looks like Joseph, even though he's now a slave in a foreign country, that he's working hard. He's industrious. He's showing a good attitude. He's being very positive. Potiphar is impressed by the man. Potiphar notices that, actually, this young man is having quite a good impact on my business, on my affairs, and promotes him and promotes him and promotes him. This may take time. It wouldn't happen, I think, in a week. And perhaps initially Potiphar might have had him out in the estates, you know, looking after the animals and so on, because that was what Joseph had some experience of doing. But over time, eventually he's made head of the household. So this is the captain of the guard, the head of the secret service, a wealthy and important person in the government, and he basically hands the entire household affairs over to Joseph. So it looks like, you know, Joseph, despite the disappointment, is continuing to work hard, to trust God, to be faithful, and is being blessed in what he's doing. Just demonstrating a great attitude under really quite an adverse situation. Hold your place there. Look at Ephesians 6 and 5 to 8. Ephesians chapter 6. This is going to come through again and again and again. You can't knock Joseph down. No matter how bad things get, how disappointing things get, Joseph just carries on being positive, being good, being good-natured, apparently just trusting faithfully and patiently, despite quite a number of severe knocks. Ephesians 6 and verses 5 to 8. And of course, Joseph didn't have the advantage of the Bible that you and I have got. He couldn't read the advice of people like Peter and people like Paul and so on. But here it says in verses 5 through 8, servants, such as Joseph was, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart, as to Christ. Obviously, that's how Joseph behaved. He was obedient, worked hard, served well, really, really impressed Potiphar. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men. And of course, that could apply to those of us who are employees. That's how we should act in our places of employment. And that's clearly how Joseph acted, even though he never read these words, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. If you turn to 1 Thessalonians 5, 16 to 18, 1 Thessalonians 5, again, Joseph had never read these words. He didn't really have the Bible. First book of the Bible is Genesis. Obviously, it hadn't been written yet because Joseph was in it. So chapter 5, verses 16 to 18. Rejoice always. Pray without ceasing. In everything, give thanks. For this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. It doesn't say give thanks for everything, but give thanks in every situation. Rejoicing and praying. It seems pretty evident between the lines that Joseph did all this. He was alive. He was in a fine home of a very important court official. He'd been promoted to high office within that, and he was thankful and grateful. Things could have been far worse, and I guess he must have been a fairly joyful character because he really seems to have, you know, impressed these people. And so notice there in verse 3 of chapter 39, back to Genesis 39, sorry, and just verse 3, notice again it says, his master saw that the Lord was with Joseph and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So it looks like, you know, Joseph might even have been talking a little bit about his God. Otherwise, how could Potiphar have known that it was the involvement of Joseph's God that was behind this? Anyway, picking up story in verse 6 just ends by saying Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. There's only two other men mentioned in Scripture are deemed to be handsome and beautiful. One was David, and one was Absalom, you know, David's son, but Joseph is the third. And that leads us into Potiphar's wife, of course, who clearly liked handsome young men. Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Now we don't know how many months or years it had taken for Joseph to rise up to be, you know, head over the household of Potiphar. We know he was 17 when he was sold into slavery, and we know later on he's 30 when he's promoted to become essentially prime minister. So that's a 13-year gap. And some of that, he's serving Potiphar, I would guess, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, who knows. And then, of course, things go slightly worse for the latter few years of that sort of time. But anyway, after he's been there for a while, Potiphar's wife casts eyes on him, and she tries to seduce him. But he refused, verse 8, and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Pretty good example, because, you know, Joseph resisted the temptation. She may have been a strikingly good-looking woman, and she's clearly, I'm sure, dressing up and got perfume on and coming across very alluring, but Joseph resists, unlike David. You'll recollect with his numerous wives and, of course, his adulterous relationship with Bathsheba. David didn't resist, out on the roof that evening and saw this lady bathing unclothed, and that led to the adultery. But here's a woman actually throwing herself at Joseph, and he just absolutely resists and says, "No way, no way." And then notice verse 9 says, "How could I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" This is long before the law was given, allegedly, at, you know, Mount Sinai. Adultery was sin in the days of Joseph and Jacob and Abraham. And Joseph knows, I mean, perhaps he could have thought to himself, well, this is a bit of all right, isn't it? I can get away with this, there's nobody else around, and, you know, I deserve something for all the hard knocks I've taken so far in my life. But he says, I can't do that. I sin in this way against my God who's favoring me. I'm here in slavery, but my God looks after me and I honor my God to sin? Absolutely not. That's a great example. So it was, verse 10, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, you know, not going to give up, that he did not heed her to lie with her or even to be with her. So clearly he tried to work out how to avoid her, using a bit of wisdom there. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work that none of the men of the house was inside. That's probably because she'd managed to somehow get them all out of the house, plotting and planning to have her way with this young man. Verse 12, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. Notice he's doing all the right things. Right? He's resisting temptation. He's trying to avoid her. She's managed to catch him out one day, and he just runs off with his garment left behind. So it was, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he," talking, I guess, to her husband, "has brought into us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice, and it happened when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. So she's obviously annoyed that she's been spurned, and of course hell hath no fury, etc. And now she's lying. She's accusing Joseph of attempted rape, even though you and I know that Joseph is completely innocent. In fact, is demonstrating some really high moral standards. Then she spoke to him with words like these. This is to Potiphar. "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to me to mock me. So it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside. So it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in the prison." Not getting any better, is it? You know, what are you going to do now if you're Joseph? You know, you've been trying to live by high moral standards. You've been working hard, doing good. You've been trusting that God will work things out in your life. And now, worse. Now do you give up? Now do you repudiate God? If this is what you get for living God's way, I want none of it. I mean, some people would say that, wouldn't they? Well, I've lost my job over trying to keep the Sabbath and the holy days. I didn't bargain for that. You know, I missed out on promotion because I won't go to, you know, the boss's parties on a Friday night and get resentful against God. But what's Joseph going to do? You know, now he's in prison for doing good things. What will he do? Verse 21. "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper." Now again, reading between the lines, God's not going to make things prosper if you're whinging, complaining, murmuring, griping, and shaking your fist at God for how unfair life is to you. So it seems quite clear that even now in prison, Joseph maintains a good attitude, serves, works hard, is spotted by the keeper of the prison as a very special young man with great attitude, great attributes, great character. And eventually the keeper says, well, I can relax here. Joseph, the prison's yours. Do with it as you see fit. I'm putting my feet up and relaxing. And that's quite amazing that Joseph gets this level of favor and demonstrates, I think, reading between the lines, just what a man he is. Really, really quite impressive and quite exceptional. And you have to wonder, I guess, whether Potiphar smelled a rat here somewhere, because he probably did know a wee bit about his wife and her characteristics. And it says he's angry, you know, there in verse 19, but he may have been angry really at being put in this position, which he knew was probably not entirely accurate. But because of the public nature, he has to sort of take action, and this is his top servant, the guy he's really, really impressed with, who's now being accused, and oh dear. And so he puts him in prison. But if he really had believed the accusation, I suspect it would have been an execution that would have followed. Attempted rape of a high government official's wife? Yeah, I think that would have been your head chopped off. So I suspect Potiphar did sort of smell a rat, and probably the best he could work out was I'll put him into the prison. The prison's in Potiphar's own property, as becomes evident, I think, in a moment or two. But, you know, Joseph is clearly an outstanding individual. That's what it seems to me. Look at, hold your place there, and look at 1 Peter 2, 18 to 23. 1 Peter chapter 2. Again, Joseph didn't have the advantage of reading these verses that you and I can do, but 1 Peter 2 and 18 to 23. And Peter writes, servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable, if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. For what credit is it if, when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer for it, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. And here's Joseph doing everything right. He's actually honoring God. He's avoiding, you know, fornication and adultery. Demonstrating very, very high moral standards. It seems he didn't perhaps defend himself to Potiphar and just accepted the blame, even though it's wrong. That's what it says here, is commendable. If you do good and you suffer for it and you take it patiently, that's, in God's eyes, that's pretty good. Joseph was just outstanding. Verse 20, to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth, talking of Jesus, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, the Lord Jesus, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. And it seems that Joseph just had that attitude, really outstanding. I guess the question you and I would have is, how do we operate if we're accused wrongfully? You know, go ballistic, atom bomb somebody.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to chapter 40 of Genesis, with Joseph, of course, now in a prison, which I think the prison is fairly clearly actually in Potiphar's own estate. And because it says, in verse 20 of the previous chapter, it says the place where the king's prisoners were confined. So this was more of a political prison. So not just the worst of the absolute riffraff. I know you don't want to be in prison at all, but I guess if you're going to be in prison, it's probably a slightly better type of prison to be in, because these are the king's prisoners, probably, political offenders and so on. And of course, in a sense, for Joseph, it's more exposure to people high in the government, although this time they'll be in jail for whatever reasons. Chapter 40. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with these two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. Well, who's the captain of the guard? Potiphar. So these are in custody in Potiphar's house in the prison where Joseph is confined, which therefore is in Potiphar's house or his estate. And the captain of the guard, that's Mr. Potiphar, charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. So in a sense, I'm sure Potiphar was doing the best he could with a difficult domestic situation. It is true, Joseph's in prison. I think one of the Psalms says that at least for some point in time, Joseph was in shackles. So it wasn't always great, but Joseph had been given now almost free run of the prison to look after it. Here these two guys, the chief butler, chief baker, are put in prison for whatever reasons. And Potiphar says, look after these guys until, you know, they're investigated and charged or whatever. Verse 5, then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with his own interpretation. And Joseph came in to them in the morning and looked at them and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, why do you look so sad today? He might have thought, well, because we're in prison. But it looks in some ways that perhaps Joseph had managed to improve the prison conditions so that actually people were okay there. Happy there? I mean, Joseph's an able administrator, that's pretty obvious. And he says, why are you guys sad? Which implies that normally, up till then, they hadn't been particularly sad. And equally, it's interesting that Joseph is thinking of other people. He could have said, hey guys, if anyone should be sad around here, it's me. I'm innocent. I'm a kid. I was defending, you know, God and his commandments, and I'm a man of honor and a good background and a wealthy father, and I'm sold, you know, because of jealousy of my brothers. I'm the one who should be sad around here. You guys cheer up. But he says, guys, what's the matter? Why do you look so sad? Which again says something about Joseph, doesn't it? Even in prison, where he is unjustly imprisoned, he's thinking about, well, these guys don't look very happy. I wonder if I can help them. And they said to him, well, we each have dreamed a dream, and there's no interpreter of it. And Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please. And obviously, I guess Joseph knows something about dreams. Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, behold, in my dream a vine was before me. In the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. And Joseph said to him, okay, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. How do you know this? It's obviously Joseph has a gift from God, as he always points to God. And now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I've done nothing here that should put me into the dungeon. That's not really a complaint, it's just somebody saying, when you're reinstated with the Pharaoh, if you could make mention of the fact that I'm here and I'm really quite innocent, that's as far as it goes to a complaint. That's not really a complaint. When the chief baker saw the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, oh, hang on, Joseph. I also was in my dream and I had three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket, there were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head. So Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you. That wasn't perhaps quite as good news for the baker. But again, it says something about Joseph. It's quite easy to give good news, isn't it? Like you're going to be liberated and set free, and a lot of preachers are quite happy to give, you know, good tidings and easy news. To give bad news, like you're going to die, is harder. To give news or to give, you know, what the Bible teaches about judgment is not as easy. But Joseph, the guy, is impressive, isn't he? Just full stop, he is impressive. Verse 20, now it came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants. And he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. I guess the baker was guilty and the butler was innocent, and after investigations, that's the way it worked out. Presumably justice applied. But you can imagine that for at least a day or two, Joseph's hopes were raised because, you know, the butler was being reinstated. And I did ask him kindly if he'd mentioned me. So perhaps in the next hour, 2 hours, the next day, I'm going to get a visitation. But he's forgotten. Isn't that unfair? Hopes dashed, sold as a slave, jailed for being innocent, helping the butler. And what do you do now? Do you despair, reject God, complain, become bitter and twisted? Well, I think we know Joseph by now, don't we? He's not going to turn. Joseph is just going to be faithful and patient and continue with a good attitude, because he is clearly just super duper outstanding. If you look at James chapter 1, verses 2 to 4, again, Joseph had no access to this information that James, Lord's brother, now giving, but he seemed to just have the right character, the right spirit, the right attitude. Because in James 1, verses 2 to 4, we're told, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. And how would you answer to that? Do you? Do I? I'd have to say, hand in heart, not always. I might try to now and then, but I guess the more natural reaction is to whinge, complain, and be bitter and unhappy and miserable and, why me, God? But you know, James says here, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, but let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. So, you know, faith continues and continues and continues and continues and continues and continues and just keeps on continuing. That's called patience. It doesn't turn. It doesn't swerve. And clearly, that's what Joseph was made of, a man who just kept going, irrespective of the disappointments that would sort of come his way. But thankfully, the end was nearly in sight. So back to Genesis and chapter 41. Would you and I have lasted like Joseph, maintained good attitudes and good spirits, kept on doing good and working hard and being appreciated by those over us, promoted to higher and higher office, even though we're being unjustly treated? Chapter 41, then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river, that would be the Nile. Suddenly there came out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking, in fact, and they fed in the meadow. Then, behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river, and the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine-looking and fat cows. And Pharaoh awoke, because you don't see that very often, do you? Then he slept and dreamed a second time, and suddenly 7 heads of grain came up on one stalk, plump and good. Then, behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them, all dry and nothing there. And the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed it was a dream, but he thought, you know, this dream was very vivid. This dream was like something about that dream tells me there's information here, but well, what do these two dreams mean? Now, it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh, not even make up a story. They just said, beyond us, old Pharaoh. The chief butler spoke to Pharaoh and said, I remember my faults this day when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, Potiphar's house, both me and the chief baker. We each dreamed a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a young Hebrew man with us, a servant of the captain of the guard, and we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man, he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came to pass just as he interpreted for us. So it happened. He restored me to my office, and he hanged him. And of course, that's quite convincing. So this guy interpreted the two dreams, and they both came true, even the good one and the bad one as well. This guy actually gave bad news, and it came to pass. Ooh, well, it's quite convincing. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh, because I guess you'd be in some sort of rags probably, whilst you're, you know, there in the dungeon. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, there's no one who can interpret it, but I've heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me, God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. So, you know, Joseph is, like I say, outstanding. He's not going to say, yeah, I can do that sort of stuff. If you let me out of prison, I'll interpret it for you. He simply says, well, actually, it's not me. It's God. God gives the interpretation, and God will give you the information you need. So he's not going to take any credit at all. Really, yeah, very impressive. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream, I stood in the bank of the river, and then seven cows came up, fine-looking, and seven other ugly cows came up of such ugliness, verse 19, as I've never seen in all the land of Egypt. They were really horrible-looking beasts. And the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first seven, the fat cows. And when they had eaten them up, well, no one would have known they'd eaten them at all, for they were just as ugly as at the beginning, and so I awoke. And then he talked about the second one. And then verse 25, Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. It's just one meaning. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years. The seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows, which came up after them, are 7 years. And the seven empty heads, blighted by the east wind, are 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I've spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following. It will be very severe. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So that's pretty impressive, I'm sure, to Pharaoh. There's interpretation. It's information you need. But rather than just saying, that's the problem, and wandering off, Joseph says, well, that's the problem, but now here's the solution. Whether God gave him this wisdom or anyway, it says, Now therefore let Pharaoh, verse 33, select a discerning and wise man. Set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. It's probable that maybe one-tenth was taken up normally by the Pharaoh. But here, Joseph's recommending you take up 20%. Now, bearing in mind, it's going to be very, 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 very abundant years. That would still leave people with much more than they would have ever had in the past, even minus 20%. Let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh. Let them keep the food in the cities. Then that food shall be a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which shall be in all the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. This is designed really to protect and save Egypt and other countries. So you should do that, O Pharaoh. So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find such a one as this man in whom is the Spirit of God? Because they were like, this guy's got it. This guy sees it. This guy's got wisdom. He's got the answer. The problem, the answer in the same breath almost. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. He clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. So you are the boss. As of right now, apart from me, the Pharaoh, you are in charge of everything in this country. You are the man. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him as wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Now he's married into a noble family. Verse 46, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. So that's quite a remarkable turnaround, isn't it? You've gone from the pit to the palace in one day. You're married. Well, I guess that might have taken just a few days or a few weeks or something, but anyway, obviously the announcement was made fairly soon, into a prestigious, noble family. So a tough 13 years for you know, Joseph, no doubt. 17, he was sold by his brothers. 30, he's now essentially the prime minister of the Egyptian Empire, and nobody does anything without his okay. And of that 13 years, a number of years were in Potiphar's service, head of his household. Now, whether that was 2, 3, or 4, or 5, or 6, or 7, or 8, or 9, or 10 years, don't know. And obviously the last 2-plus years was in the prison. But now you've gone from all of that, and just by being patient, and working hard, and being good, and having a great attitude, God has favoured you, and favoured you, and favoured you, and you've had a few knocks, disappointments, but now, I mean, you know, one morning he woke up in a, you know, prison cell, perhaps on a straw mattress, and the next morning he wakes up, he's in a sumptuous bedroom with, you know, linen and cotton, and his own servants coming to bring him in, you know, fresh fruit for breakfast. Happened that quickly. You know, God can change situations that quickly for those who are obviously patient and faithful. And don't get bitter and twisted and shake their fist at God. And why has this happened to me? Why have you allowed this? You know, he's quite outstanding, this young man. Verse 47. Now in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was without number. So 7, you know, absolutely stupendous harvests, and they were taking 20% off the people, and the people were keeping 80%, but 80% of a massive harvest is probably a lot better than they've ever seen before. And of course, the 20% is for their own ultimate benefit as well. And to Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, the priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. For God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. So Manasseh means forgetting. And then the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. That means fruitful. And of course Manasseh and Ephraim, I think we know something about. Later on, Israel would adopt these two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and give his name Israel to them. And of course today we believe that Ephraim descendants are to be found largely in the British Isles and the parts of the former British Empire, and Manasseh largely to be found in the United States of America. And all took place, all happened way back here. Verse 53, then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. The famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread, because of all the stores which were there. And that was something, don't forget, to forecast 14 years ahead of time. When the young, former prisoner standing there saying, 7 years like this and 7 years like that, that's a prediction that's going to take you 14 years into the future. Quite a long way. Verse 55, so when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, whatever he says to you, do. The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened up all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in their lands. So far, so good. Joseph's in a fine position. But what's happening back home? What's happening back in the land of Canaan? What's happened to Joseph's wonderful brethren and his old father? We'll pick that story up in chapter 42. And the best part of 20 years or so is now elapsed. Don't forget, you've had the 13 years that Joseph was working for Potiphar and or in prison. Then you've had the 7 good years of abundance. So 20 years has now elapsed since Joseph was sold into slavery. 20 years since his father last saw him. 20 years since Reuben and Judah and Simeon and so on last saw him. 20 years has passed. Verse 1 of chapter 42. When Jacob saw that there was grain in Egypt, Jacob said to his sons, why do you look at one another? Why are you looking so perplexed? Why are you looking so uncomfortable? Because we all know there's grain in Egypt. So, why are we all here not doing something about it? But of course, the reality probably is that Joseph's brothers don't like to think of Egypt much, because that's where they sold their younger brother down to. And they probably think their younger brother's either still in slavery or maybe dead by now, and there's a bit of a guilty conscience. And nobody likes to talk about Egypt because it brings back bad memories of when we sold Joseph to the group that were going down to Egypt. So we don't really like thinking about Egypt much. And so they're all staring at each other, trying to avoid the topic. Verse 2, and he said, indeed, I've heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down to that place and buy for us there, that we may live and not die. So when your dad tells you to go, they've got to now go. So Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, lest some calamity befall him. Joseph actually suffered quite a bit with fear and so on. So he's keeping Benjamin behind, but the other 10 guys, they can go off. And the sons of Israel went to buy grain among those who journeyed, for the famine was in the land of Canaan as well. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the earth. Oh, one harkens back. Does that not seem like a dream 20 years earlier? Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he acted as a stranger to them and spoke roughly to them. And he said to them, where do you come from? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. So Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And you wouldn't really, would you? I mean, they were quite a bit older than Joseph, probably didn't change a lot, and still in their normal garments of the family, etc. But I mean, Joseph was only 17. And from 17 to like now 37, he's bigger. he's heavier, he's wearing different clothes, he's speaking through an interpreter. So they just don't recognize him. And why would you? You would expect to find your little brother as governor over Egypt. So they just don't recognize him. Verse 9, then Joseph remembered the dreams which he had dreamed about them and said to them, you are spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land. And they said to him, no, my lord, but your servants have come to buy food. Joseph looks like he's being a bit hard with him here, but it becomes evident later on that there's some good work being done with the minds of these guys that they need to go through. And it's evident that Joseph doesn't entirely like having to treat them this way, but I think he's looking for certain evidence in them that they've changed over time, and that becomes obvious later. And they said, no, my lord, verse 10, your servants have come to buy food. We are all one man's sons. We are honest men. Well, perhaps. Your servants are not spies. You know, we're not 10 guys from different territories come to spy the land. We're all one family, actually. We are. And they said, your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with her father today, and one is no more. But let's hurry over that part. But Joseph said to them, it is as I spoke to you, saying, you are spies. Okay, in this manner you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place until your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, and you, other nine, shall be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there is any truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. So he put them all in prison for 3 days. Then Joseph said to him the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you, go and carry grain for the famine of your houses, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. So, you know, their guilt is still alive, because the first thing they're thinking of is because of what we did to Joseph all those years ago. Remember when he cried out to us and he pleaded and we just ignored him and were rough with him and we sent him packing down to Egypt? It's all because of that. And Reuben answered them, saying, didn't I not speak to you, saying, do not sin against the boy, and you would not listen? Therefore, behold, his blood is now required of us. But they did not know that Joseph understood them, for he had spoken to them through an interpreter. And he turned himself away from them and wept. And then he returned to them again and talked with them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. So they've got a guilty conscience. It's playing in their minds. It's probably played in their minds, to be fair, for 20-odd years. Now, this terrible situation they're in. They've been accused of being spies. Simeon's going to be taken as a prisoner. They're going to be sent back with one other brother missing now. And it's all because of what we did to Joseph. Why did we do it? Why were we so carnal? Oh, dear. And they're starting to go through a process, at least, of really thinking through the consequences of those terrible decisions. Verse 24, Joseph took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. He's going to keep the one brother until the youngest brother is brought back. Then Joseph gave a command to fill their sacks with grain, to restore every man's money to his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. Thus he did for them. And so they loaded their donkeys with the grain and departed from there. But as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey feed at the encampment, he saw his money, and there it was in the mouth of his sack. So he said to his brothers, my money has been restored, and there it is in my sack. And then their hearts failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, what is this that God has done to us? They think something bad's happening here. We're cursed, we're cursed. Then they went to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, and told him all that had happened to them, saying, the man who is the lord of the land spoke roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. But we said to him, we are honest men. With a straight face, no doubt. We are not spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more. And the youngest is with her father this day in the land of Canaan. Then the man, the lord of the country, said to us, By this I will know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for the famine of your households and be gone, and bring your youngest brother to me, so that I shall know that you are not spies, but that you are honest men. And of course, don't forget, Benjamin is actually Joseph's literal brother, same mother. So it's his really, really, really brother. And I will deliver your brother to you, and you may trade in the land. Then it happened, as they emptied their sacks, that surprisingly, each man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And you want to take Benjamin away? All these things are against me. Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, talking of Benjamin, and I will bring him back to you. But Jacob said, My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, talking of Joseph, and he is left alone. If any calamity should befall him along the way in which you go, you would bring down my grey hair with sorrow to the grave. And I guess I'll leave it there, because time is now up. Not too much to go, but I think you can see, in fact, the main part of the story is now over, but you really can see that Joseph is somebody really, really special. He's like a real believer, a good Christian. The man has trust and faith in God and patience and a good attitude and works hard and impresses people. And despite really one adversity after another, he just keeps on going, faithful, trusting, almost it seems with a smile on his lips, counting it all joy when he falls into diverse trials. So really, really a very outstanding individual, and one, I think quite clearly it wouldn't be a bad idea for us to be able to emulate Joseph, probably a bit wiser in some ways than trying to emulate David, who had a few rough patches in his life. Anyway, with that, brethren, we'll conclude today's Bible study.